This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Before we get into the show today, I want to pass along a couple of reminders for people who don't have power or access to the internet to get these kinds of notifications. First, boil orders. There are boil orders in effect for all customers of the Collier County Public Utilities Department, including Goodland. Also, from the Inglewood Water District, water service has been restored to the barrier island of Manasota Key. But here, too, as a precaution, a boil water notice has been issued. These boil orders are in effect until water system repairs and acceptable bacteriological testing is completed. The testing is scheduled to be done as water repairs are finished. In Charlotte County, the boil order for the area west of Miyaka River has been canceled, and right now there is no countywide boil order in effect for Lee County. On Sanibel, the Sanibel Recreation Center is open and available for residents for charging of electrical devices, showers, a cooling station, and that is located at 3880 Sanibel Captiva Road. Also on the island, the Center for Life at 2401 Library Way is open for charging of electrical devices and for use as a cooling station. On the roads, people are reminded that when traffic lights are out, intersections are to be treated as a four-way stop. Law enforcement would like to also remind people that the men and women working to restore electricity, water, and sewer, traffic signals, and to clear storm-related debris from the roadways are just feet from traffic and inattentive drivers. These workers need your help to keep them safe so they can go home to their families. And it's not just the workers who face work zone dangers. More than 90% of all work zone incidents and result in driver or passenger injuries, too. Here's some roadway work zone survival tips. Slow down, pay attention. Watch for bucket trucks, cranes, and other vehicles in intersections, medians, and along the side of roadways. Eliminate your distractions. Florida law bans texting while driving. Expect delays and plan for them, and leave early enough to reach your destination on time, and observe all the posted signs. Also, Hendry County is establishing a food distribution center at the Household Hazardous Waste Center in LaBelle, located at 1360 Forestry Division Road. Other food distribution locations in the county are being developed now, and more details will become available shortly. For extra updates on Hendry County, you can visit their website at www.preparehendry.com. Also, grab a pen, because here are some important numbers coming from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. It's advising people impacted by Hurricane Irma to get in touch. Residents from Lee County, as well as Charlotte, Collier, Hillsborough, Manatee, Miami-Dade, Monroe, Pinellas, or Sarasota counties, can go to disasterassistance.gov to register for federal assistance. If you can't register online or through the FEMA app, you can give them a call at 800-621-FEMA. That's 800-621-3362. Applicants are going to need the following to apply: a Social Security number, daytime telephone number, current mailing address, and a zip code of the damaged property. Also, private insurance information if you have that available. And now to the show. Among the hardest hit areas in Southwest Florida is a community that could least afford it. Immokalee in eastern Collier County is a town well known for its concentration of field workers, new U.S. residents, and working class families. It's the polar opposite of the neighborhoods that line Collier's beaches in western Naples. As the sun has shone for the past few days, it's become clear that this area is seeing a much slower recovery than other places along Hurricane Irma's path. Yesterday, Governor Rick Scott toured Lee County, and when asked what area stood out to him, Immokalee was the one he said broke his heart.
Well, just locally, you go out to Immokalee and you know they don't have a lot of money and they lost their power, and they, you know, you see homes damaged out there. The people are so, you know, they're so sweet, they're hardworking.
We are joined now by Abby Wendell and Camilla Domonoski, reporting on Hurricane Irma for National Public Radio, who were just out in Immokalee yesterday. Ladies, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks for having us.
Camilla, Immokalee is right on our doorstep in Collier County, but we have listeners that are further to the north who don't know much about it. Tell me a little bit about the community and why you chose to feature that in your reporting.
We were looking for a community that would provide a contrast to some of what we'd been seeing, like you said, right there along the coast, driving around Naples, seeing the damage there, and knowing that the impact of losing power, of having to evacuate briefly, of having damage to your property is very different if you're in a comfortable financial position and if you are barely scraping by. And so we went to a community where there's a very high rate of people with very limited incomes who had to find the money to prepare for this storm, had to ride out the storm, and then go home to houses that, in many cases, we saw some severe damage. We saw flooding and people who are struggling to figure out how to move forward from here. in a community where there's power outages, phone lines down, and it's hard to get to food or water. People are very struggling. Yeah,
it's really scary for them, and it's so interesting, maybe coming from the outside, to look at the disparity between the two. I mean, they're what, 30 minutes apart?
Yeah, it was so close and such different worlds. Same storm, you know, you'd see the same trees down, but they were being cleared right off the streets in Naples and still, you know,
still
right
laying
there.
Across the streets over in Immokalee. Huh?
And we saw flooding around houses that had been sitting there, standing water around a house, completely encircling it below the level of the road, like a reflecting pond. And it had been there for days. The water was starting to smell. And the people who lived in that house, I talked to Olga Garza, and she, you know, had contacted the city, contacted the county and asked for help with drainage and said that nobody had come.
Yeah, I just don't even. So, Camila, Immokalee, I'm sorry, Abby, you've seen Collier and Lee counties before, right? You've seen during, before, after the storm. What's different about Immokalee compared to other parts of Southwest Florida for you? I mean, when you're up close and personal looking at it.
Well, I actually don't know the area that well.
Okay.
But driving into Immokalee, it was obvious that agriculture, like citrus groves, were everywhere. A lot of that agriculture was flooded, and it seemed like a lot of people, like you said, that's their jobs. And some of the people that we spoke to said that they, you know, one of the ways in which this is really going to impact them is they're on a limited income and it's like hourly wages, and they weren't sure when they were actually going to get back to work and when they would be paid again in order to help pay for some of the financial difficulties that the storm has put them through. Like Camila said, people had to prepare to you know, weather the storm. One woman we spoke with, Patrona Gaspar, she paid $500 for hotel rooms, and I'm not sure why she didn't go to a shelter, but she sought refuge in a hotel room and then like another $200 for food. So that's $500, and between her and her husband, they only bring in $800 a month.
That's going to be tough. I mean, so not only are they dealing with the short-term panic of I don't have enough food, but then they also have the long-term specter of when am I ever going to get back to work?
Exactly. She was, you know, she was going to see maybe a week's worth of paycheck coming in, but then she wasn't going to be able to work again because there's no child care in the area. And so she has a young daughter, 2 years old, and she was going to have to like watch her daughter because she doesn't have any family there. So she wasn't going to be able to work, and that means she's not going to get paid.
And we have one of the people that you interviewed telling us about the fear about when getting back to work is going to happen. Let's listen to that.
I told her I'm going to have to take the whole week off because I don't have anybody here and the daycares are closed and I don't have no family here. They all left up north and I don't have nobody to watch my baby. So, it means they don't pay.
And not only that, but like you were mentioning earlier, Camila, these people, they're calling for help and they're not seeing that happen.
Yeah, we heard that. We heard that from several people. You know, just driving down the street, we were stopped and hailed by a guy who said, you know, I need help. I'm 70 years old. You know, I've had heart surgery and there's no one to help me clear this debris. Where's the assistance? Where's the help? People are definitely feeling alone as they're facing this recovery. We heard that again and again.
And they're isolated in a way that I haven't experienced traveling around other parts of Florida. You know, when you go there, it's a dead zone. One woman we spoke with said she's heard that Comcast is offering free Wi-Fi, but it doesn't matter because they can't get a signal. So it's hard for them to like reach out to anybody and say, hey, we need help.
And are there a lot of grocery stores in that area? Did you see any of them?
I mean, when we rolled into town, there was a line outside of the Dollar General, and we heard that people were being walked like one person at a time through the store with a worker and a flashlight who was writing down by hand what they were buying and how much it would cost, because I guess, you know, their electricity is down for their machines. We followed Patrona to her house to see her trailer, which was completely damaged. And by the time that we got back, they had closed the Dollar General. So people were pulling into the parking lot like, I don't have food. I don't have water for my kids. What am I supposed to do? And, you know, I'm not sure.
And you also talked with you mentioned 24-year-old Patrona Gaspar about the disparity between what she thinks is going to happen with Immokalee versus what's happening already in other parts of the county. Let's listen to that.
I think so. I think they would get more because it's a bigger community and it's more wealthy people there that are going to get the help first than what we are.
Why do you think that?
I it's just the way it was. Naples usually gets everything first, and then I guess we get the hand-me-downs from them.
Did you get that feeling from a lot of people, Abby? Did a lot of people kind of feel like they're getting the hand-me-downs whenever people are tired of helping with disaster relief for other places than they think of them?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely got that feeling that they were kind of a forgotten community. A couple people said that, you know, they've weathered big storms in Florida before, but the thing that made this unique is the fact that usually help comes right away. And what, this was day three or day four, you know, and they weren't seeing any of that help coming. And I mean, you know, I guess it kind of makes sense because you have a lot of big hospital facilities and stuff in Naples. Some of the people from Immokalee said that they come this direction for work. So it makes sense that you would want to get those kinds of things online first. But, you know, I guess when you have a hurricane that engulfs the entire
state
and then
yeah.
states above it even, it's kind of like, you know, you have to triage and they feel like they're getting the bottom of the bucket.
And it's also hard to understate just how critical it is. There's another resident that you talked with that sounded kind of alarmed about the lack of supplies for families. Let's listen to him.
In the market, they don't got no water. They don't got no water, no food for their kids. All the stores closed. But this is the first time that thing happened. I got like 25 years in this country. Lala hurricane. The next day we got help. I don't know what's going on now.
Yeah, a lot of hurricanes, and this time I don't know what's going on. He's been here for 25 years, he said.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine. I think Immokalee, like, they typically don't really trust the water, was the impression I got. So it was unclear if there was, like, waste in the water, and that's why people were being told to boil. Well, they couldn't boil it because they didn't have electricity,
yeah.
right? I mean, food is something you get hungry, right? But, like, water you need. You need water, like, immediately. Kids need water immediately. You can't last very long without water. And they were running out of bottled water in the stores. The stores were closed down. They didn't have enough gas in order to get out of town to find bottled water. You think about Naples.
Yeah, you're out there in the Immokalee is kind of an outpost, you know? I mean,
yeah.
You can't just drive to the next town. It's a long way.
Well, people don't have any gas.
If you don't have gas.
And gas stations don't have any gas. So
exactly.
Are you supposed to start it's, you know, 90 degrees outside. It's sunny. You're dehydrated. You've got three kids. You're supposed to walk to Naples in order to be able to buy water that in Naples costs $6 for a bottle, you know, where you can get a whole case for $7 in that community. I mean,
yeah, it's a very different story. And the other problem is there are people out there, Camila, I imagine that you talked with, that had stocked up on food, but that's going to run out after a little while, and it's already been a few days.
Yeah, you know, there were people standing in line outside a convenience store saying, like, we're waiting to be let in. They're being let in a few at a time, and they hope that there's food inside because their supplies are running low. You know, you can only stock up so much. And the food shortage is intense, the water needs, and the heat, I think. An important thing to remember when you're thinking about what the situation is like, it is hot, there's standing water, that humidity is coming up, and there's no air conditioning to be found. You can't even find a refuge if your house doesn't have AC. There's nowhere else you can go to get any.
Yeah. If you're a vulnerable population, right? If you're older, younger, yeah.
It's a critical situation out in Immokalee right now. So I guess it's good that you went and you brought some light to that, because hopefully that's not too far down the road for us to get there, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both, Abby Wendell and Camila Domonoski, for reporting for NPR here in Southwest Florida. Thanks for telling us about what's happening out there.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
We are talking about Hurricane Irma today and the recovery efforts that are just beginning in many places. What are you seeing? Give us a call with your storm stories at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we are at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. The Florida Keys were hit especially hard by Hurricane Irma. The storm made landfall on the island chain Sunday as a Category 4 hurricane. Recovery is happening slowly, with emergency personnel and relief workers still among the few allowed back on the island chain. FEMA estimates that 25% of the homes in the Keys are destroyed, an additional 65% damaged. Right now, officials are making headway in repairing roads and airports and opening up critical infrastructure like hospitals and electricity. The Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority is advising residents to boil their tap water before drinking it. Everywhere in the Keys, Monroe County officials say power, water, fuel, and other resources are limited. And here to give her perspective is longtime Florida Keys reporter Nancy Klingner with WLRN. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
What's it like there right now?
It's really, really hot. And in Key West, it's pretty calm. People are, clearing the streets, clearing out their yards if they can, getting generators up, that kind of thing.
So what kind of things are standing and what things are not? Are like the old standbys like Sloppy Joe's, things like that, are those standing still? And then are other newer construction not standing?
Absolutely. Key West itself really did not have any kind of major structural damage. The only buildings that were really hurt here were if a tree fell on it and directly on it. The real problem is in the lower Keys, the area from about Big Coppet Key, which is, say, 10 miles east of Key West, up to the 7-mile bridge. That's where Irma went across on Cudjoe Key, which is about mile marker, 22. And the area to the east of that, Summerlin Key, Big Pine Key, those were the areas in the really nasty parts of the storm, and those are the areas that are seeing the devastation. They are already letting people back into the upper Keys, where they're in pretty good shape up there.
Have you been able to go to those lower Keys?
Yeah, I was up on Sugarloaf Key yesterday, and again, the structural damage wasn't too bad there, worse than in Key West. Mobile homes and older structures didn't do too well, had some roof damage and stuff like that. But Big Pine Key is where the real devastation, I think, is. And I haven't been up there yet, but I'm going to be going up there tomorrow.
All right. Well, I'm sure that we will hear about that on our station because we'll be carrying that. There are a lot of people that are interested in it. How is the bridge situation? I know that whole area is very famous for its long chain of bridges. Any of those severely damaged?
Nope. The bridges are all good. The highway is open. So that is a huge relief. The big problem we're facing is our water supply. The Florida Keys Aqueduct Authority supplies fresh water to the island chain from a well field on the mainland, so we are dependent on this 150-mile pipeline. And the pipeline itself is not the problem. It's the distribution system. So every tree that uprooted a pipe or every mobile home where the water wasn't turned off has become a gusher. So they are losing millions of gallons when they turn the system on. So they have the system off, and here in Key West, we're on a rationing of about 2 hours a day when they turn the water on, and we all rush and take showers and fill up our buckets and do all that stuff, and that's it for water, which is a little bit scary.
Yeah, that's really something you kind of take for granted in times when there's not a problem. So they're working their way down the line from the mainland down those pipes to stop it up?
I think they're working their way along the distribution center, along the distribution system, trying to stop the worst gushers, the worst leaks, wherever they can find them and where they can isolate sections. We have a reverse osmosis plant, a desalination plant here in Key West on Stock Island that they have turned on, and there's one up in Marathon. So they can separately supply parts of the Keys, but they need to have a distribution system where they're not just pouring millions of gallons of water into the air or the ground.
So communications kind of got knocked out. How long did that last?
We just got our first cell sort of service back last night, early this morning. If you have AT&T and you can get a kind of a very basic system in some places, where you can do voice and text. It's not hugely reliable, but it is something, and it's a lot more than we had. But, yeah, until this morning, we were entirely based on a few old landlines that miraculously still work, like the one I'm talking to you on right now. But that's been a really scary thing because the first responders can't talk to each other. There's no 911. The cops are using point-to-point radio. It's just been really, really difficult. And it's been difficult, as a journalist to try to get the word out.
Yeah, you're trying to report, and it's hard to let people know what's going on and where they can go. I'm sure there are a lot of people wondering how far they can go down that island chain to get back home or to check on properties. What is the current situation as far as people being able to get back down as far as Key West?
See, that's the kind of thing that somebody on the mainland with an internet connection would have a much, much better handle on than I would.
Oh, it's hard to get that kind of communication all the way down there.
Yeah, absolutely. But they're all over social media and on the web and on the radio, I assume, to tell people about that. As I said yesterday, they were opening up the upper Keys so people who lived down to mile marker 80 could come back or had a business. They may have opened it up more, but I honestly don't know. I mean, our only form of communication or information here is talking to people on landlines like this, and there's one terrestrial radio station on Sugarloaf Key that stayed on the air all through the storm and is still on the air, and they're getting information by people coming to the station, or they have, I think, a landline or two open.
Wow. It's extra primitive at this point, but... All right, I want to thank you, Nancy Klingner, for joining us and telling us the latest from down there in Key West, and best wishes.
Thanks a lot.
And in Hendry County, farmers and ranchers sustained significant damage to their crops and lands after Hurricane Irma touched down on southwest Florida Sunday afternoon and then ravaged its way up the coast. WGCU's Jessica Mazzaro spoke with University of Florida's regional vegetable extension agent at Hendry in Hendry. His name is Gene McAvoy. He's still out there assessing the damage.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Gutwine Grove in Hendry County, just south of LaBelle.
What are you seeing out there?
I'm seeing a mess. I'm seeing uprooted citrus trees. I'm seeing up to 75% of the fruit laying on the ground. They've done a good job in this location of moving a lot of the water out, so the flooding is not as extensive as I've seen in other groves I've visited today.
What else have you seen today? What's been worse than
what
you've
seen? A lot of the groves are basically the trees, the beds, you know, that the trees are grown on are underwater. Fruit is floating in the water. Trees have been uprooted, especially on the ends and sides of the groves, tearing up the irrigation system. I've been to several vegetable farms. Plastic that had been laid for the fall crop is totally gone. I went to one tomato farm that had lost 524 acres of plastic, and each acre of plastic is approximately $2,000. So you can do the quick math. That's over $1 million right there, and they'll have to redo that entirely before they can plant. So it will be a good month before they can start planting those fields again. Crops that were in the ground, they had also planted about 90 acres of tomatoes. They're totally gone, and that'll all have to be replanted as well. So normally we try to start harvesting in late October for the Thanksgiving market. We might miss that one this year.
I know it's still early to tell. You're just assessing the damage now. Do we have any indication what kind of a hit any of these industries have taken?
Well, on a whole, you know, I would say the losses are in the billions. I would not be surprised if it exceeds $2 billion. It's hard to, you know, put individual numbers. As I said, just that one farm, just in terms of plastic, was over $1 million. And then, you know, they had damage to some of their internal roads. They had damage to some of their buildings. So, again, that's going to cost them money to put that back into place. Just past a packing house at Fry Farms, the sides of the house have been blown away. So they're going to have to, you know, rebuild that building. Power lines are out to this area. So, again, power is going to have to be restored before a lot of work can be done.
How many places have you visited so far or seen with your own eyes, at least some farms or ranches, since the hurricane passed?
Personally, I have been to about a dozen. Staff is also out, and I'm also getting texts and emails as I drive along. So, you know, we're getting a lot of information, and we'll know more as we go along.
What are some common themes, I guess, coming from these, you know, from your own personal experiences and the calls that you're getting?
Well, you know, it's overwhelming, but again, you know, this is not the first time for most growers. You know, we've seen freezes, we've seen hurricanes. You know, they're going to pull up their socks and you know, get back at it. And that's all you can do. It gets a little overwhelming at sometimes. You know, I know, you know, a couple of guys told me they felt like crying. And sometimes I do as well. But, you know, we've been fortunate and, you know, we haven't lost lives. And this can be all rebuilt.
What advice would you give, you know, physically get the farms and the ranches and everything back together,
well,
but also mentally?
They know better than I do. You know, one of the things I'm advising is to document as much as they can the losses. Even the floodwaters, you know, yesterday compared to today are starting to recede in some places. So you know, the more documentation you can have when that insurance agent comes along, you know, when he comes, the water may be gone, but that doesn't mean that, you know, it wasn't there. So, you know, take photographs, document, you know, in terms of rebuilding, farmers know better than anybody what they need to do to get it done. You know, we're going to see some, especially in citrus, some long-term issues. When you get these groves flooded like this, it's going to impact the root system. They're going to have long-term problems with fungal diseases like Phytophthora. So, again, it's, you know, it's not only the immediate aspect of the fruit blowing off the trees, but it's the long-term effect. And yeah, as you know, citrus is hurting already, horribly hurting from greening, and this is just not going to be a good thing for that industry.
What do you say to them for any kind of hope?
You know, really, they want to talk to somebody and, you know, talk about their problems. And, you know, again, you know, an extension, being an extension agent, you know, I'm a scientist, I'm a horticulturist, but a lot of times you have to be a sociologist and a friend. And that's what I'm trying to do today.
Has this taken a toll on you as well? I mean, having to, every single person, you know.
Well, it's, you know, it's, again, this is my life, Jessica. And I think you can probably hear my voice affects me. And these people are, you know, these are my friends. These are just not clients. These are friends.
What do you project the next few days or weeks looking like in Southwest Florida?
Well, again, we're going to be rebuilding. We're going to be, you know, getting out there and doing what we can. You know, one of the big things that I do is to get the information out to the authorities to make sure that, you know, the state and federal people know the true impact of what has happened here in Southwest Florida. You know, there's a process. You know, the governor has already declared an emergency. You know, their counties have to be declared disaster areas, which, and then, you know, state has to request federal assistance that has to be granted. Monies have to be appropriated. So it's a long-term healing, and it's going to take a long time.
Well, thank you so much for what you're doing, and I look forward to touring with you guys and I get to see what you do in person.
Okay, thank you.
That was the University of Florida's Jean McAvoy debriefing WGCU's Jessica Mazaros on Southwest Florida agriculture losses sustained after Hurricane Irma. And as a reminder, in Hendry County, a food distribution center is being established at the Household Hazardous Waste Collection Center in LaBelle, which is located at 1360 Forestry Division Road, where you turn at the EMS station right off of Cowboy Way. Other food distribution locations in the county are being developed now, and more details will be available shortly. For additional updates from Hendry County, please visit www.preparehendry.com. Coming up, we'll talk with one of the country's leading disaster cleanup companies about what steps homeowners can take to try to get their homes back to normal. And we'll hear about some critical needs at local hospitals and blood suppliers. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Before we get back into the show, I want to remind people that there are boil orders in effect for all customers of the Collier County Public Utilities Department, including Goodland. Also from the Inglewood Water District, water service has been restored to the barrier island of Manasota Key. But here, too, as a precaution, a boil water notice has been issued. These boil orders are in effect until water system repairs and acceptable bacteriological testing is completed. The testing is scheduled to be done as water repairs are finished. In Charlotte County, the boil order for the area west of Miaka River has been canceled, and right now there is no countywide boil order in effect for Lee County. Also, I want to remind people to grab a pen here because there are some important numbers coming from FEMA by the Federal Emergency Management Administration advising people impacted by Hurricane Irma to get in touch. Residents from Lee County, as well as Charlotte, Collier, Hillsborough, Manatee, Miami-Dade, Monroe, Pinellas, and Sarasota counties can go to disasterassistance.gov to register for federal assistance. If you're unable to register online, you can go through the FEMA app or you can call 800-621-FEMA. That's 800-621-FEMA. 3362. Applicants are going to need the following to apply for this federal assistance. You're going to need a Social Security number, a daytime telephone number, current mailing address, and a zip code of the damaged property as well, and private insurance information if you have that available. One of the more vital parts of any community is its medical infrastructure. And throughout this storm, Lee Health has remained online and is now facing some critical needs in the wake of the storm, as so many people are without power. Barbara Kinney is the Director of Care Management for Lee Health and joins us now on the phone. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're most welcome.
So what's happening right now at Lee Health?
Oh, well, we're a little bit challenged, but we feel as though we're meeting the need. One of our biggest issues right now is really trying to reintegrate our special needs and some of our sheltered patients back into the community so we can make room for new patients coming in. In doing so, we're working with the county so that we can have an extended special needs shelter area. That might be a good solution since so many people are without power. We have a medically fragile community. Our elderly population really don't fare as well when they don't have power. It's hard enough for us as young people, but those that have lung disease or any kind of chronic situation, putting them in a home in that kind of stress with no power really deteriorates their own medical stability. So just the, really at this point, not having power is a national disaster for these type of folks. So we're really working hard to try to find a solution for them.
So Lee Health, were you able to be a shelter during the eye of the storm, during when the storm passed over? You had some special needs people that you were caring for there, and now you're trying to get them back in a position where they have power?
Well, we're trying to reintegrate them back to their homes or back to friends or back to something that the county might be able to help us provide for them that does have power.
Okay, yeah.
So the county actually had 1,100 people sign up for their special needs. They were able to accommodate most of those in their special needs shelter. They designated 100 of them to come to acute care hospitals because their needs exceeded what a shelter would be able to.
Okay.
They may have ventilators, feeding tubes, suction equipment, tracheostomy tubes. So there's some pretty extreme needs. And then there's simpler needs, like they just simply need oxygen. Oxygen tanks work without power, but their life is low. You need a lot of oxygen tanks to really serve you on a 24-hour basis.
So oxygen is one of the oxygen is one of the main needs that people have that will require, not necessarily require, but it works a lot better when you have electrical power. What are some of the other things that people need? Things like dialysis or anything like that?
Now, dialysis has not been as big of an issue, mostly because of how our community outpatient centers prepared. Maybe it's lessons learned from recent Harvey. But they did establish, Fresenius and DaVita established an 800 number. They were able to get two local clinics up and running and then additionally Monday so that all of their patients were able to call their local number and the 800 number and be filtered into an open spot. They worked till 10 o'clock at night. So I think that they met that need to a great detail. We got the information, and when people called us, we were able to help them with that. And then, some of them did have to come in and be dialyzed here and then, sent back out again. It's a need, but I think it's a controlled need that we've been dealing and handling well with our community partners.
So what is something that you...
The other is the asthmatics. A simple nebulizer requires electricity. When you're an asthmatic and you can't breathe, nothing else matters. That's life-threatening. So that's equipment that really needs electricity. Feeding tubes do. Some patients just have tracheostomy tubes, but they need suctioning, and suctioning requires electricity. So those are. Now, we've got a lot of community patients that are very medically complex on ventilators, and they are reliant on nursing agencies to staff them 12 to 24 hours a day in the home. So they might have power, but they don't have that nursing support because the nursing agencies are really taxed getting their staff back to work to meet their normal current level of service. So that's really been an issue for some of our community.
Well,
but
and you also
nursing facility. Sorry,
but you also have an entire team of people that are working with these patients, and they have also been impacted. How has your staff been?
Staff are holding up. We sheltered About 1,100 of our own staff during Team A and Team B just during the hurricane, and we're just filtering all of them back out. So for our own staff with Lee Health, they've really met the challenge. They have a good attitude, and they're serving the patients, and they're volunteering to come in extra. So we really feel that we've covered that in a real positive way. We've been able to feed everyone that's housed in our building up through tomorrow, where they haven't had to extend any money. So food services has really met the need in that way. Really, during the storm, we had people sleeping in every possible area within the building. We did have people in the community that turned us at the last minute as a shelter. We accommodated as many as we could and had to send some to the ones that were open. Ones that we could, we fit them in.
Are there some messages you want to get out to the general population as far as accessing care at Lee Health? I mean, I know you're fully operational and things, but as you're making these transitions, do you want people to rely on urgent care centers?
Most definitely. All of the Lee Health urgent care centers are back online now. The first to come up was the Page Field and Pine Island, but we're all open, so that is a much better alternative than our ERs, although our ERs are here, and our triage centers are here for that, but that would be a better solution for simpler things. Mm-hmm. A big takeaway, though, is we have had some come in with carbon monoxide poisoning, so the operation of your generators is really, really critical. Of being in ventilated areas. That is a something the community really needs to pay attention to.
Yeah, we can't remind people of that enough. You know, but this electricity being out for so long, and you can't put it in your garage either. It has to be outside.
Correct. And make sure that outside is ventilated. So that's really been an issue. I think a big takeaway for the community is getting those that are medically fragile, either needing simple things like oxygen, or you can't survive without power, you've got to register with the special needs shelter ahead of time. And the county has a process for that. You can go online to do it. They accepted 1,100 people prior to the storm, 100 of them designated for acute care. But once the storm came, hundreds came were not on the list. So being proactive to register for the primary care physicians to not only remind your patients, but really follow up to be sure that those that are fragile really do that follow up. Because I think that is really the biggest takeaway. It will relieve a lot of stress from the community. The other is when the county makes arrangements for you to be picked up to come into the shelter, you need to adhere to that. A lot of people said, no, I'm not ready to go yet, or no, I don't think I need to. And then the county got busy with all the other needs, and they wanted to get back and picked up. And that really created an issue. So registering early and adhering when they're ready to pick you up, really abiding by that and going with that plan, it was really critical.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Barbara Kinney, the Director of Care Management for Lee Health. Thanks for telling us about how things are going there and some of those important takeaways about pre-registering if you have medical needs. Thanks so much.
Very good. Thank you.
If you've ever had to rebuild after a storm or a natural disaster, the name Paul Davis may be familiar. The company, operating out of Jacksonville, Florida, has been specializing in recovering homes and buildings faced with the unimaginable for 50 years. The residents in Southwest Florida are now facing recovery and remodel projects, big and small, and we turn to the company's Senior Vice President, Brad Cowan. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hi, Julie. How are you today?
Doing good, but the big question is, how are you in Jacksonville? A lot of flooding up there. Before we get into damage repair, did you get a lot of damage from Irma?
Yeah, well, me personally, I dodged a bullet. We had a couple of trees down, but we missed out on the flooding. And so, looking around Jacksonville, obviously there's some historic flooding along the St. John's River and some of the tributaries. And, from what we hear, is that the flooding rose to levels that the city hasn't seen really since, the mid-1800s. So, but me and most of our employees, we have a lot of employees here in Jacksonville, everybody's safe, and outside, some minor damage, we're in pretty good shape.
Well, that's good news, but I'm sure you're incredibly busy. So we have people that are facing damage from siding, roofs, fallen trees. I guess the question right now, Brad, is where do people start when it comes to rebuilding?
Well, I mean, I think the number one thing that, you know, when we go into a home and help people in their time of need is really, you know, safety issues. You know, if you're going back into your home, the number one issue really is slipping and falling. So, you know, be careful about that. You know, any sort of electrical issues, you need to be very aware of that. And also, when you get back in your home, you know, look overhead. If you see your ceiling is sagging or wet, it could be holding a lot of water, and obviously water is very heavy, and the ceiling could fall and hurt you. So I think, you know, just when you get back into your home, to be thinking about safety issues would probably be the number one concern.
Do you think that people should get started right away trying to fix things, or do you think they need to wait for an insurance appraiser to get there to make sure everything is as damaged as they say it is?
Well, I think, you know, most of the insurance carriers would say to call the agent first. So, you know, I think that's most likely one of the first calls that most of our customers have made. But, you know, really mitigating the damage really is about, you know, getting in there and, you know, drying things out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it's pretty important to get ahead of that mold, you know, especially here in Florida.
Exactly. It's warm here. So, you know, really just getting in and, you know, flood water can be contaminated. So getting in as quickly as possible, you know, as safely as possible, remove, you know, what's necessary and really start the drying process.
Is there, and I wanted to ask you about that flood water, is there anything different about flood water that's going to require different attention or different kind of cleaning process than something like a leaking faucet or an overflowing air conditioner unit? Because I mean, the quantity is obviously going to be greater when there's a flood, but is there anything people should be aware of about the water itself?
Well, yeah, it's not clean. You know, obviously it has all types of contaminants in it. You know, if you have just a leaky faucet, you know, that water is generally very clean, and so, you know, drying that out would be a much simpler process. You know, if you're dealing with contaminated water, then you're going to have to tear out, you know, more of the carpet. Anything that's really been, you know, soaked with that type of water needs to be torn out because of some of the contamination. And so, you know, you do have to handle those jobs, you know, much differently than, you know, if it was a faucet or something like that.
So when you're dealing with flood water, you'd probably advise, obviously, using the rubber gloves and rubber boots. Do you think that it's important also to protect yourself with breathing with some sort of a mask?
You know, it probably wouldn't hurt. Certainly, you know, depending on how severe, you know, the water, how badly contaminated the water is, whether it's sewage or whether it's just flood water, but, you know, certainly to do anything that you need to do, you know, to protect yourself. But it would be a good idea.
And every time we have a disaster like this or anything, you know, that widespread repairs are going to be needed, we always get the warnings about shady contractors, people without licenses or scammers. Is there anything people should look out for when they're hiring a disaster cleanup company?
You know, I think you just look for a reputable company who has been certified. You know, there's, I guess, an institute, third-party institute within the industry called IICRC, which it's, I guess, they do standards, certifications to, you know, mitigation companies. And so if I was looking, you know, to bring someone into my home, I would look to see if they had certifications. You know, at Paul Davis, we embrace training. And so that's one area that that we ensure that our folks, if they're going to come into your home, that they've had, you know, the proper certifications.
Yeah, we recently did a story here on this show about contractors and making sure you have one that has a license. So there is a certification process for this kind of thing for cleanup.
Yes, there is. Yeah, it's really the independent, I guess, certification firm is IICRC. It's the Institute of Inspection, Cleaning, and Certifications. And so that's really the third-party organization that does industry standards and certifications for people in the industry.
All right. So as people are preparing to rebuild or remodel after the storm, what kind of services and specialties do you think people are going to be thinking about? Things like a roofer or a drywall installer?
Yeah, you know, generally, you know, you probably sometimes the first thing that customers will be looking for is, you know, someone maybe to remove trees, come in and do tarping and board up and those type of things. And then, you know, next generally you would go to some form of, you know, drying process, so get the water out if the property's wet. And then, you know, obviously, you know, going from there, whether it's new flooring or, drywall, those type of things, typically would come next, and depending on the damage, all the way up to a full, you know, reconstruction.
So, I mean, hopefully people don't go through many disasters in their lifetime, so we're not, you know, generally all that familiar with what happens when you call a disaster cleanup company. When you call someone, for example, I call your company and say, hey, can you come help me out with this? Am I looking at signing a contract or anything like that? And what exactly does the cleanup company do?
Yeah, well, normally, you know, we'll come out and do everything that we can, and, you know, to mitigate any, you know, additional damages. So, you know, a lot of what we do really is going to be around tarping and board up, coming in and, you know, disaster restoration, getting the water out of the home, and doing those type of things, trying to mitigate any additional damages. And so, we really are, I would say, one of the first lines of, you know, the first folks you should call, or first lines of defense to, you know, prevent additional damage to your home.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just getting the disaster to stop happening is basically what you're saying.
Exactly. Getting everything stabilized and, getting everybody back to kind of their pre-loss condition, you know, as fast as possible.
Is there anything that people should look out for in any of those kinds of contracts when they agree to have a company come into their home?
You know, I think you just make sure that you work with a reputable, you know, company. There's a lot of reputable companies, national companies that have good brand awareness. You're most likely talking with your insurance carrier. Sometimes they'll, have recommendations of people that they work with and have, you know, had good experience with. And so I think, you know, just looking for someone reputable would probably be, a good start.
And I know it's kind of hard to say what this costs because, you know, every house is different and every damage situation is different. But how do they set pricing when they're trying to when they're dealing with someone who's had their house flooded? Is it based on how many dryers you have to use, how many hours it takes to get all the carpet out and the hauling of away of all the product? What kind of things are people being charged for?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say a little bit of all of the above, kind of like what you mentioned. I guess it depends on how much water's in the home, how deep it was in the home. Was it contaminated or did it come from, again, like you said, maybe a leaking faucet? Do you have carpet, wood floors? I think there's a lot of factors that would go into that. I would say really just depends on the size of the loss, how much water you had in your home, those type of factors really would lead to, you know, the cost to repair.
So there's no real average fee or anything?
I don't know that. Yeah, it'd be hard to give you an average. I mean, there's not just a straight, price based on, maybe how the square foot or something like that. A lot of times it would depend on how much water you had in your home. And, you know, there's all the factors that you talked about that could impact the cost. But, you know, generally speaking, if you're working with an insurance carrier, they're going to have certain guidelines as well to make sure that you're getting charged the right price.
Yeah, and do you work in concert with insurance companies, or does a disaster mitigation company work with insurance companies for as far as setting these types of prices or anything?
Well, we certainly have, programs to where we support, insurance companies when their customers have claims. And so I would say that, a lot of our customers would be referred either by the insurance company giving out Paul Davis's name and a lot of our customers just call us directly. So, but we absolutely, if there's an insurance company out there who has customers who need help, they'll refer them to us to go and help out.
Yeah, and I understand that it's kind of hard to have an average fee because every square foot is not exactly the same.
Right. The interesting thing is, you there's so many variables in a home. I mean, people have different contents and different flooring and different furniture, and so it's hard to have just a set price. But I would say, you know, the size of the damage, the type of water, and how much water was in the home, and then how long it was in the home. I'd say if you were really looking at some drivers, you know, those factors would really, you know, determine the type of repairs that would be, you know, needed to get you back to normal.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, is there any way, is drywall and our baseboards that are wood, are they ever salvageable if they get wet?
You know, absolutely. If it's contaminated water, generally speaking, you wouldn't keep that. But if it's just clean water, if you had, a pipe burst, as long as you can get in there quickly, I mean, we normally like, you know, to try to get in there certainly within 2 or 3 days where possible, you certainly can dry, that type of material in place, if you get there quickly. And, you know, it's not contaminated water. Generally, if you have contaminated water, you're going to want to pull that out.
Yeah, the contaminated being the flood water. I guess rainwater wouldn't qualify as the contaminated.
Well, I mean, it would really depend, you know, if it, you know, came from the roof and, you know, typically, you know, that may not qualify as contaminated water. But you need to look at that close and just make sure that it really was a clean source, you know, before you made that decision. But, you know, certainly if it came up from the ground, you know, came in your front door, it's going to be contaminated.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much, Brad Cowan from Paul Davis. Thanks for joining and being part of our show, because I think a lot of people are looking at some repairs down here.
Julie, thank you so much. Hope you all have a good day.
We will. Thanks so much. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chinqui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.